Hello, everybody. I'm Jamie Scray. I'm an executive consultant and co-founder with DTA Associates. I lead our patient experience practice, which includes a big component of provider communication and coaching. I couldn't be more excited to be joined today by two wonderful individuals who are going to talk to us a little bit about telehealth, communications, and equity in healthcare. First off, we have Dr. Ryan Jelinek. He's a board-certified internal medicine physician at Hennepin Healthcare, and he practices in both the inpatient and ambulatory settings. He completed his medical school training at Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, followed by a residency in internal medicine at Hennepin Healthcare. He's nearing completion of a fellowship in clinical informatics at Hennepin as the inaugural fellow there. Much of his second-year fellowship was devoted to researching and building more equitable telehealth platforms, along with training the GME trainees on how to effectively deliver high-quality care via telehealth. Ryan also serves as a member of the Advisory Council to Great Plains Telehealth Resource and Assistance Center, GPTREC, where telehealth strategy is developed for organizations nationwide. He will be moving into a leadership position at Hennepin Healthcare upon completion of his fellowship, where he will continue to work on the strategy around developing and training to effective forms of telehealth utilization. Welcome, Dr. Jelinek. Also joining me is Sheila Delaney Maroney, MPH. Sheila is the Patient Experience Officer and Senior Director of Person-Centered Programs and Services at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, Hennepin Healthcare. Her responsibilities include oversight of organizational strategies for improving the patient and family experience, the integration of experience-based design methodologies into program development, process improvement, and space design. And also, operational responsibilities include interpreter services, spiritual care services, patient relations, welcome services, patient and family partners, and the Inspire Arts Program. Sheila is a frequent national speaker and founding member of the Patient Experience Policy Forum and a board member for the Patient Revolution. Sheila's healthcare career includes extensive health policy work as a consultant and program director at the National Institute of Health Policy under the leadership of former U.S. Senator Dave Durenberger. She's a graduate of Boston College and the University of Minnesota School of Public Health and spent 10 years working in public relations, fundraising, program development, and health education at Boston Children's Hospital and a community health clinic in Boston's inner city. Sheila's graduate school and policy work focused on the role of the consumer in defining and accessing the ideal healthcare experience using shared decision making and collaborative system design. And I have to say, I've just been privileged to get to know both Ryan and Sheila in our work with the Provider Communication Academy at Hennepin Healthcare this past year. So welcome to both of you. I'm so glad that you could join me today.
Thank you, Janice. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Awesome. Well, thanks for making some time. And, you know, we're going to talk about telehealth and equity today. I think it's super appropriate that we're actually joining each other virtually. So that seems to just be the way of the world. But I'm really glad that we're able to connect. So I want to start us off. And Ryan, I'm wondering if you can take us back and tell us a little bit about what was the telehealth strategy at Hennepin prior to, let's say, January of 2020?
Yeah, which seems like ages ago now, but it's, we didn't have much of a strategy. I think we had a few of the pieces in place that you would look at for what you would consider to be a robust telehealth platform. We were live with e-visits, which are an asynchronous form of telehealth. And we had a nurse telehealth line where patients could call in and get some questions answered. And then they would really just be triaged to the next phase of care. So in terms of like a direct-to-patient experience around telehealth, we really didn't have much prior to the pandemic. And I think a lot of healthcare organizations were in that position. There's a multitude of reasons why that was. I think us being a safety net organization with a larger Medicaid population, there were some issues on the payer side of things that made it really fragmented and difficult to reimburse for these services. And a lot of that changed during the public health emergency, which is a big part of the reason why you saw this emergence of telehealth exploding, right? Not just because patients couldn't physically come into the location, but because a lot of the things on the regulatory side changed. So before the pandemic, we were really in the dark ages in terms of telehealth. And I think it's really a testament to reflect on how far we've come in such a short period of time.
Absolutely. And I think, like you said, that was true for so many organizations. I think those listening will probably really resonate with that path. Sheila, I want to turn to you and ask kind of two things. One, can you tell us just a little bit more about Hennepin Healthcare? I realize we've referred to it a couple different times, and Ryan was just mentioning a safety net hospital, but I think it'd be helpful to just give folks who aren't familiar with Minneapolis kind of a context of Hennepin. And then if you can also just share a little bit about how did COVID-19 impact. Can you just take us back to March or February of 2020, and just how did that start to change things in the organization?
So quickly on the Hennepin Healthcare profile, we are a level one trauma center, teaching hospital of the University of Minnesota. We are a safety net hospital, member of America's Essential Hospitals. We have about 450 beds. We're a one hospital system, but we are a vast infrastructure of healthcare services, including reaching close to 1 million ambulatory visits a year. We have our own EMS company that transports patients around the city about 45,000 times a year. We have a very large and active emergency department. We're the poison control center for the state. And we have a very, very diverse patient population. I think somewhere around 65% of our patients are covered by government payers. 20% plus of our patients speak a language other than English as their preferred language. They come from dozens and dozens of different countries. We have a very large new immigrant population, particularly from East Africa in Minnesota at present, plus some other significant diverse patient populations and communities of color here. So quite a range, and we're right in the heart of downtown Minneapolis where all the action is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So take us back to, you know, just a little over, you know, maybe a year ago from right now when we're recording. How did COVID-19 impact the organization?
Well, I would say one universal experience was that it was like an immediate blackout for everybody. So starting with how we interacted with one another, we immediately stopped meeting in rooms and seeing each other in person. And so became our way of communicating with one another right away. We all had to learn Zoom and Teams and Skype and whatever the tools at hand were. So telework was sort of the first thing that happened to us. But then I think for patients, it probably really truly felt like a blackout because they did not have that easy access and potential just run into someone in the hallway kind of experience. And I think they felt like they lost their lifeline to their trusted care providers right at a time when this mysterious virus was the dominant news story. And so I think they probably felt very vulnerable and afraid and really hungry for contact with Hennepin.
Yeah, no, so true. It's sometimes tough to kind of go back and think about those days early on. And I was struck as you were talking just about the litany of programs that so many of us have learned to use in this time, the skills we've built. So Ryan, can you take us through, you said how there wasn't really much of a strategy prior to January of 2020 for telehealth and e-visits. What happened once the pandemic hit? What did you do for telehealth? And tell us a little bit about that part of the journey.
Yeah, well, I can tell you both from an individual perspective and then kind of from the perspective of our organization. So my backstory, when I started my clinical informatics fellowship in 2019, I went to my program director and I said, you know, one of my goals for my fellowship is to leave and have some level of expertise around telehealth. And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, okay, well, we'll see what we can do, right? Because at that time, we didn't have much of a telehealth platform. And then come March 2020, things changed really, really quickly. And so I was presented with a really interesting opportunity to be at an organization that had a very little footprint in terms of their telehealth platform and be in the role of a learner as well as a clinical informatics fellow. And so that to me was a really golden opportunity in the midst of some pretty terrible stuff happening in our hospital and community. So it was an interesting juxtaposition of this opportunity. in the midst of the pandemic for me personally. And what an education it turned out to be. It's really shaped the direction of my career path in several ways. And so it was an amazing chance to learn how to build a platform from the ground up, but also in a space where we had to be very thoughtful about the platform that we were building because of the patients that we take care of. And so from an organization standpoint, we knew very early on when we had to start closing our clinic doors that we had to do something very quickly. And I think that's where Hennepin Healthcare is a little bit different from other organizations that were thrust into that position. And what I mean by that is, so the way to do things quickly is just to implement an out-of-the-box solution, which a lot of places don't really have a choice because they just don't have the resources or the level of expertise to build anything other than that. And so you take these out-of-the-box solutions and then you implement them, and you are kind of put into a box that you need to make sure that that works. So what Hennepin Healthcare had to do, because we took the out-of-the-box solution at first because we needed something quick and we needed something that was going to be effective in that moment, we started that down that path and realized this isn't going to work for our patients, right? We have access issues to broadband, to technology. We have digital literacy issues. We have limited English proficiency issues with our population that a lot of other healthcare organizations don't have on the scale that we have. And so we were in a position where we had to think creatively and thoughtfully around how to build these platforms in a way that was equitable for our patient population. And so I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but that's where Sheila and my path crossed initially is this work group that was designed solely for the purpose of making sure that we were building systems with equity at the forefront of everything that we designed and built. And I think that's the really cool thing that we had the chance to do with this organization that I don't think other organizations had the resources to do. And a lot of other organizations didn't have the impetus to do it nearly as much as we did here.
Yeah. No. So I have kind of two questions kind of coming off of that. First off is tell us a little bit more about how you did build it. Like, what did you do that is probably really different than what some of those other organizations were facing? And along with that, how did you prepare the care team, like the providers, the others who may be involved in kind of getting the patient queued up and ready for that visit? Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the thing that we did that was probably most important is we really developed and studied the problem itself. And we took a full picture of end to end what's happening when a patient goes through a telehealth encounter, all the way from, well, do they even have the materials necessary? So the technology, the hardware, the broadband, the literacy levels, all the way to the end of the process with the provider, you know, in front of a computer screen. And so we analyzed every step of that process using some lean methodologies and really started to ask ourselves the whys, right? So if these go wrong, why is that? And then ask that question again and again and again until you get to the root cause of these issues. And then from there, we figure out, well, how can we address these root causes in a systematic fashion? And so I think that's where the collaboration between our technology teams, our provider teams, and Sheila's team with the patient experience was instrumental in understanding what is it that the patients actually need from this process, right? Not what can I deliver with the technology that we have available, but what do we actually need to deliver for the patient to experience this in a way that's going to work for them? And so I think that whole process of making sure that we actually understood the problem before we developed the solutions is instrumental in building a platform that actually works to deliver high quality, equitable care.
That's awesome. Can I jump in and add, you asked about how did we prepare the providers? And I want to give kudos to Ryan and the team and to the providers who were essentially asked to learn a brand new language in a very, very short amount of time. Just the wealth of information and resources and tools that they had to absorb within days, really. If looking, we have a resource page for providers on our internal web, and it is a vast, vast library of things that they, lessons they really had to learn and absorb. And so I want to just acknowledge that it may, it's fabulous that Ryan mentioned what patients wanted, but we also really were asking our providers to step up in a very short amount of time to do a huge amount of learning and absorption and change management of their own.
Yeah, and we have so much to build on that too. I think that it's interesting to have observed this, and I've been doing some teaching with the internal medicine residents at this organization and teaching them how to do telehealth. And when I started this, I think rather naively, I thought, well, this is going to be a pretty quick thing where we just teach them how to use the hardware and the software, and they'll figure out the rest. They're doctors, right? And that's not the case. This is a very different modality in that you are not in this, you know, ritual space of the exam room where you've been trained on how to do this procedure over and over again, where you walk in, the patient's sitting in the same spot, you talk, you listen, you ask them to move to the exam table, you do your physical exam, you know all the movements to make with your hands, and you go through this process, and it's very repetitive, and it's something that you've been trained to extensively. And then to remove all of those fixed pieces and now turn them all into variables, and not just variables, but they're highly variable, right? Like, I don't know where the patient's going to be. They could be in a car. They could have a really poor connection. They may have very low levels of digital literacy, and they might not really be able to complete the physical exam maneuvers that you're trying to have them to do by moving the camera around. And so there's all these variables that I hadn't thought of when we first went into this. Because if you look prior to this, a lot of the curriculums that did exist in these little pockets around telehealth education talk about things like website manner, which is, you know, making sure you're presenting yourself in the digital space the same way you would in person. And those are all really important. But I think when you get into the more nuanced pieces of, well, how do I control for some of these variables in a clinical setting where you're expecting the same degree of quality when it comes to your outcomes, that hadn't been talked about. Mm-hmm. And so I think now you're seeing some of these larger, you know, physician organizations and telehealth organizations saying, we need to really come up with more robust curricula for learners, but really we need to make sure that we're doing that for existing faculty and staff too, because this is all very, very new for them. And when I think about this in kind of a broader scope, this is kind of analogous to the transition from paper records to electronic health records. And I think a lot of the learners at that time were trained in the environment where you obtain and document your findings in an electronic manner. And now we're doing that same in transition, but from an in-person encounter to a virtual encounter. And so I think making sure that not just our learners, so medical students, residents, fellows, but also our existing faculty have the support and the training they need to succeed in this environment, because really ultimately what it comes down to is it's going to affect patient outcomes. And I think we'll talk about this in a bit, but patients really like this, but they'll start to not like it if the doctor on the other end of the screen doesn't feel comfortable with what they're doing. And so I think that's where we have to be really mindful of how we build these systems moving forward, but also how we support the providers on the other end as they navigate through these new systems.
The bookend to providing, equipping the providers with the tools and the skills and the confidence, we also have learned, and I think need to continue to expand upon the training, essentially, and the empowerment of patients to be successful. Patients don't want to waste doctors' time. They don't want to get it wrong. They want to make sure that when the visit date, the time for the visit is, you know, scheduled, that they are ready technologically and otherwise. There's a lot that we also have to do to support patients to be successful in this relationship. And I applaud Ryan for really putting some great tools in place and working with a lot of people in our organization to make sure that our patients can be successful, because they desperately want to be good patients in quotes, and they don't want to mess up. So I have an 85-year-old mother who loves telehealth. She does almost all of her visits now via telehealth, but she calls me or one of my siblings first to make sure she knows how to connect to Zoom every single time. So they want to be successful. And that leads a little into this equity conversation as well. So, you know, my 85-year-old mother has 6 children to call, and we all know how to use technology. And that's not the case necessarily for everybody we serve at Hennepin. People speak a different language. They are a new immigrant to and haven't ever had access to technology before. Maybe it's their, you know, their 16-year-old son who has the smartphone that they're going to use for their visit. There are issues around where people live and how many people they live with. So Ryan talked about sort of the sanctuary of the exam room. Well, the patient is now in their home, and they might actually have 3 or 4 kids hanging around behind them, and they no longer have privacy to talk about the personal health issues that they previously did, though they do like being in the home setting in most cases. Or it's the 16-year-old, you know, young woman who needs to talk to her OB about something that maybe she doesn't want her parents to hear. So there's a lot of equity issues that are not necessarily only about the color of your skin or your ethnicity or your language. There's a lot of other components, social components that go into it. And so with our CMIO, Dr. Pandita, and several other providers and people who are interested in population health and equity at Hennepin, we convened a telehealth access and equity team. And our job was to focus on these issues of equity. And the first thing we did, as Ryan described around process for technology, et cetera, is we went out and explored what were the issues and concerns and interests of our patients. So Dr. Kate Vickery did a phenomenal study with I could name a lot of other people, but in the interest of time, I'll use her name first, to really understand what was going to be the appetite of our patients and their capability to participate in telehealth. And we have a tendency at Hennepin to say our patients as if everybody is the same. And we also have a tendency to make assumptions, and I don't think it's just at Hennepin. I think in healthcare in general, we make broad generalizations about our patients and assume they can or cannot do something based on what we think. And what Kate's work did was uncover an appetite, a capacity, and a capability for telehealth that I think surprised a lot of people. I don't think it surprised Ryan and I, but it did surprise a lot of other people. So it was that was our sort of starting point for our equity work. I would also add, and then let Ryan jump in, that I think telehealth is really at the confluence of everything we're striving to do as an organization. It really is accelerating our work around health disparities. It's accelerating our agenda around equity and inclusion. It is not the sole solution to those things, but it is a phenomenal complement to the other efforts we have in place to reduce health disparities, because we're really going to where the patient is. We are not asking them to seek healthcare on our terms. We're recalibrating really the whole relationship and bringing healthcare to them on their terms rather than the other way around, which has been our traditional approach.
Yeah, I echo everything Sheila said, and that last piece for me was really the kind of the catalyst to me thinking about telehealth differently. I think, as I alluded to earlier, when I started fellowship, I was like, oh, telehealth is cool. This is the way of the future for healthcare delivery. And I was thinking about that in a different context. When we started doing it and I started meeting with patients and talking with patients, what I learned was that this is a game changer from the standpoint of access to healthcare. This takes that patient who, in order to see me in the clinic for a 15-minute visit, potentially has to take time off of their hourly wage job. They have to pay for transportation, whether that's public transportation or private transportation. They have to pay for parking. Heaven forbid they have children that they're responsible for, and they have to find childcare. And so now you start thinking about this 15-minute visit, and it's bookended by all of these things that are incredibly difficult for anyone to navigate, let alone some of our patients whose lives have a level of chaos that it's very difficult to comprehend. And so you start thinking about all of these invisible barriers to getting to healthcare appointments, and the ability to eliminate them completely with one implementation of a platform like telehealth is just so incredibly powerful in really flipping the narrative around what it means to access healthcare. And so I think starting to think about it in that context for me was really the catalyst to think about telehealth in a very different light. This is a cool technology, and I do think it is the way of the future, but I think it is the way of the future in healthcare for very different reasons than I previously thought of them. A couple other things, Sheila, I want to add to, you know, she was talking about how our team set out to better understand the problem and some of the things we did. One of the most interesting elements of that problem discovery phase was some of us listened in on recordings from the Connection Center. So the Connection Center is where patients call to schedule appointments. They can ask questions. They can be connected to our Nurse Telehealth Resource Center. There's a number of different branching points there, but primarily that's where patients were scheduling their telehealth appointments for the first time. And so that may be their first exposure to telehealth in general. And some of the learnings we took from just listening to those recordings were really fascinating. And one of those is that we realized that the scripting around scheduling these telehealth appointments used the word, would you like this visit to be in person or virtual? And so virtual, from the standpoint of an English word, is pretty ambiguous. You know, like, does that mean like I strap on like a headset and like I'm going to see my doctor in front of me? Like, what does that even mean? Now translate that into Somali, right? Like, I have no idea what the word virtual in that context translates to in another language. And neither did our patients. And so inevitably, when they were presented with this option, they would say no. And it led to further questions around, well, I don't know, it seemed intimidating. I have no idea what that is. And it wasn't being explained to me. And so that led us down this pathway of like, man, words matter on the front end so much when you're trying to introduce a new concept. And what can we do to remedy that? How can we play a role in educating about this new modality of care that we know has, you know, objectively wonderful consequences from the standpoint of access to healthcare. So that totally reframed the problem from the standpoint of, man, we need to stop thinking about this just in terms of like the care delivery aspect, but farther upstream, right? We need to go to the point of introducing the concept of what this is for the very first time and make sure that we do that in a way that is equitable and understandable to all of our patients. And kind of on that note, Sheila, I think from your perspective, you know, having a master's in public health and working with patient experience, I think digital literacy is really going to be the next public health frontier. Mm-hmm. I think that when you start thinking about how patients access not just healthcare, but their finances and how they stay connected with friends and family, that degree of digital literacy is going to separate you. And you hear this term called the digital divide. And if you're not careful with how you implement your systems, the digital divide will continue to grow and grow and grow. And it just fuels these disparities that we have. And so I haven't heard this as much as I want to, but I really think that looking at digital literacy as the next public health frontier is going to be a driver of how we think about public health from the standpoint of accessing healthcare, very much so in the decade to come.
Absolutely.
Really great point, Ryan. And I'll just piggyback on that to call to the to just make a note of there's a national organization led by the Beryl Institute. It's called the Patient Experience Policy Forum, and the foundational concept of this policy forum is that it's 2x2. So health system leaders are partnered with patients to in all ways to develop a policy platform, and they have put out a position paper on this very topic that you're referencing, and the number one position that they and we, I am involved in it, has taken is that everybody needs access to telehealth and enabling technology equally, but we cannot allow technology and the digital healthcare to become another social determinant of health that is a barrier that is further exacerbating the barriers that people are experiencing. So digital literacy is for sure part of that, and ensuring everybody's equipped, again, to be a successful patient and a successful consumer of healthcare.
Absolutely. I appreciate the work that you've done with that group, Sheila, and I think position papers and advocacy groups like that are super important as we're kind of moving forward and out of this time and into this the next chapter, as both of you have described it. I am curious, just a quick note, to what have you heard from your patients? You know, Sheila, as you all have now rolled this out and you all took such a thoughtful and planful approach with listening and really designing, and I'm so impressed by that. I'm just curious, what reactions did you hear from patients?
Well, apart from the technology concerns and questions about how do I use Zoom, there are some very positives. Reduced travel time, for sure. Ryan referenced getting on the bus. But we also have patients because of some of the specialties we offer at Hennepin, and I'm sure health systems around the country have this as well. People are accustomed to driving 3 hours from outstate Minnesota to come here for one or more of our specialists. And they no longer have to get up and drive 3 hours to come for an hour visit. And in a very compromised state in some cases, you know, you think about someone who might have ALS, for example. That is a massive, massive effort that is counterproductive to their health and well-being. And so a lot of people have talked about the geographic convenience of not having to travel to any one of our clinics or to our downtown campus. A lot of people consider it to be a much more, in a sort of unexpected way, actually a more personal experience than sitting in our exam room, in our environment. And so I'm now, the patient will say, I've now invited the doctor into my home. And it's, again, sort of, it's on my terms. And they really delight in the opportunity to let the provider know a little bit more about themselves. It comes more naturally to have a guitar behind you and for the doctor to be, or the provider to be able to say, I see a guitar. You like to play the guitar? I like to play the guitar. And there ends up being this completely different and unique relationship that they haven't had. One of our chief of psychiatry actually had that example, and he said, I've known this patient for 20 years and our therapeutic relationship is pretty positive, but I had no idea that he was a musician, and it has changed our conversation. And so patients really appreciate that opportunity. Another story was a patient said, I was able to run to my medicine clinic with my Zoom camera and show the doctor everything that was in the cabinet that they were interested in knowing about versus piling it all into a bag and hauling it downtown to the exam room. It has really become a much more appealing way for patients to say, here is who I am. Here is where my real life is happening. And can you help me fit healthcare into it?
Sheila, I just want to add on to that, because from a provider standpoint, one of the things that providers will push back on is they say, well, I can't get the same quality or level of a physical exam. Mm-hmm. And so one of the great anecdotes I've stumbled across in doing this over the last year is we had a patient who was in his home, and an older guy that didn't like to come into clinic very often. And he was on a telehealth visit with myself and one of the residents. And he started talking about his hands hurting, and we got into this conversation about his wood carving, and I asked him if he had any wood carvings that he could show me. And so in the process of asking that, he stands up and gets out of his chair, and I watch him walk down the hall, and the resident watches him walk down the hall, and we both kind of look at, and the guy can hardly walk. And that wasn't something that he was even talking about. It wasn't problemless. We had no idea that he had this degree of limitation with ambulating. And so he brings back his wood carving, which, by the way, was incredible. Honestly, this is one of the most incredible wood carvings I've ever seen. And both the resident and I just mouths agape, like, this thing was amazing. But it led to this conversation about watching his gait, and it wasn't something that he brought up. And we had this whole conversation about, well, now he can't get around. And between that and all of these art fair is being closed down because of COVID. He's having a lot of financial issues. And it led to this whole conversation about social drivers of health, his financial instability, his inability to get around. And all of that was because he was at home. I asked him to see a thing that was important to him. And also he was beaming about this wood carving. I mean, this was such a moment of connection between all three of us and the fact that we helped him diagnose a medical problem. If he was in the clinic, none of that would have happened. The wood carving wouldn't have been there. I would have asked him to move the 3 feet from the chair to the exam table. And maybe if I was really astute and was observing him very closely, I would have noticed something. But it wasn't something that he was complaining about. It wasn't a problem. But I saw him do this because he walked down the hall. And I don't see that as a provider in the clinic because I'm in this room, they come from the lobby, and I don't see any movement. And so it really, as a provider and as a new provider learning how to practice medicine still, those types of opportunities are just so rich in terms of providing better care, but also building better relationships with patients. And so that was a real aha moment where it's like, man, this is so much more in terms of ability to provide high levels of care. And so that's one of several anecdotes that just strikes me as it checks all the boxes, you know, and it is not a replacement for in-person care. And that's the other kind of narrative that I want to dispel is that we now have a medical system that is in tiers, and there's different tiers that you can access care through, right? And it's the same thing as if you come into the clinic, I don't always need to admit you to the hospital. Sometimes I do. Sometimes you need to go to the emergency department, right? And so now we have these other tiers where you can fall into, and it's going to take time for patients and providers alike to understand, well, which tier does this patient belong into? And that gets back to training and education too. On the whole, I agree with what Sheila has been saying, that patients love this, and I think it's just going to take more exposure and opportunity for providers to see it on that same level.
Absolutely. I love the stories that both of you have shared and just the richness and the learnings that have come from this time, and the gifts that has been, I think is fantastic. One quick question. I know that a lot of organizations, and I'm guessing this is a little bit of the story at Huntington as well, set up the telehealth. Some people propped it up in a couple of days. They saw this huge bolus of visits in kind of the late spring, early summer. And then as things sort of opened up again, then more, you know, in-person visits started back up. And now a lot of organizations are trying to figure out, okay, what is our percentage of, virtual visits and the telehealth component versus the in-person moving forward? What have you settled into there? What are the goals and plans around that at Huntington?
I think it really varies widely between different departments and specialties. We've seen certain pockets really glom onto telehealth as a modality of care delivery that works really, really well for them and their patients. As you alluded to, everybody saw this initial exponential rise in telehealth volume, and that came out of necessity because they couldn't come in person. And then if you look at the levels nationally around claims data and everything else, it levels out and then it drops down quite a bit, but now it's plateaued. And if you break that into different specialties, you see very different stories. And I don't know exactly why that is. I have some theories on different areas and specialties in medicine. And one of those is around mental health. Our mental health department or psychiatry department, which is a series of different clinics and subspecialties, really has taken off with telehealth, and for several reasons. One, if you're a patient experiencing a mental health crisis, the last thing you want to do is come into a physical location with a crowded waiting room with other people experiencing mental health crises and, sit there and then see your provider in somewhat of a sterile environment. And that's not really comfortable. It's not your home. And so it makes a lot of sense that mental health care has really taken off nationally with telehealth. It also allows them the ability to do group visits in a way that they weren't able to do before. They don't have to have everyone come from different areas of really the state into a room where right now it's not exactly safe to do. But it was never necessarily comfortable to do. Now, that's not to say they won't go back to, you know, in-person meetings and group sessions like that, but it's given people the option to say, if I can't make it, I can still participate. And if I'm not feeling like I can leave the house today because of my depression or anxiety, I can still make it today. And I think that's where the mental health piece of this has really taken off. And I don't think they're going to look back. I mean, at our organization, our mental health visits are about 80% telehealth at this point versus 20% in person. So they've completely flipped where they were, you know, less than a year ago. Other areas where we're seeing things take off are like maternal health. Our OBGYN department has gotten into looking into using telehealth plus remote patient monitoring, sending the pregnant mothers home with a blood pressure cuff to monitor for preeclampsia. They've had a lot of success with that, whereas convincing someone to come in just to have their blood pressure checked all the way to a downtown clinic was previously very difficult to do. And, you know, there's maternal and fetal morbidity and mortality that go along with not diagnosing those things. So these are life-saving interventions and changes that are happening on the back of telehealth. But then there's areas that haven't picked up quite as much. And I don't know entirely why that is. I think a lot of it has to do with conversations that we've had previously around supporting the providers and supporting the patients. You know, if you need to do a good pulmonary exam, can you ever do that over telehealth? I don't know. I think so. I think that we're going to see the schematics and the framework of where these visits fit into telehealth, getting back to that tiered system, we're going to see those develop and mature in the next few years because we're not there yet. And I think you'll start to see a little bit more of a leveling off and not these wide disparities between different specialties.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to keep talking to both of you all day about this. Your passion about this topic and so many other questions that are coming to mind. you've been so generous with your time, and I realize I need to let you go in just a second. But I'm curious if you both could share, you know, one big learning, an aha, something you really want to take forward out of this time. If you could just share that with us as we close together today.
I'm sorry, I cannot limit it to just one. So I'll go really quickly. One of the most powerful lessons is healthcare can indeed turn on a dime. We have historically, you know, convinced ourselves that we're too big and too complicated to move fast, but we can absolutely turn on a dime. And especially if you have an information services and technology team like we have at Hennepin. They are amazing. I think that the second thing I would take away is patients are very adaptable and willing to experiment with us if we bring them into the conversation and treat them as partners in the design and rollout of whatever new initiative that we're interested in. They will give us lots of really, really powerful insights that will help us steer us in the right direction. And I would also close by saying human connection is still essential. And so focusing not only on the technology as an enabler, but in the communication skills and the facilitating human connection and digital empathy is an essential component moving forward.
Awesome.
Yeah, those are just great takeaways. Like Sheila, I have so many kind of aha light bulb turning on moments throughout this process. And like I said, it's been such a wonderful opportunity for me to experience this as a learner in a clinical informatics fellowship. And it's weird to think of having such a great opportunity come on the back of tragedy. But I think we need to find silver linings in this pandemic, and we need to say, okay, what did we learn from this, and how do we move forward and not just prevent things like this from happening in the future, but how can we improve our systems, learning from the mistakes of our past? And kind of thinking about the mistakes of our past, one of the things that I learned from this process is don't make assumptions. Don't rely on preconceived notions about what your patients can and can't do. Do the research and listen. And one of the things that we at Hennepin previously thought was that our patient population, being in the socioeconomic position that they were in and the vulnerable position they were in, would not have the access to the technology needed to participate in this type of care delivery mechanism. And we had some incredible researchers put out this community needs survey that looked to address that question. And what we found was exactly the opposite, in that not only did almost 80% of our patients have access to that technology, but they wanted to use it for this purpose. And so I think that was a dangerous bias that we had in terms of thinking about what our patients wanted without actually asking them that question and making sure that we knew all of those, basic answers before we started building a system on top of that, right? And I think you need to make sure that you understand the foundation of the building before you build the rest of it. And that's what we did in this process. And that for me as a learner in informatics and as a physician are just incredibly valuable lessons that I think we will all carry with us as we move forward and try to improve access to healthcare and the quality of the care that we can deliver.
Oh, that's so well said. And I've so enjoyed our time together. I can't thank you both enough for being here. And I also just want to applaud the elements of resiliency and innovation. I think the amount of hope and really just the thoughtful approach and humility that you both have taken as leaders and that speaks to your organization's culture and approach to this on behalf of your patients and in this community as well. So thank you both. I have to say my face hurts from smiling because even though this is an audio recording for the podcast, we could each other and just the passion that both of you have and everything that you're saying. I just have been sitting here smiling the whole time and loving what we're talking about. So thank you so much for your time and we appreciate the great work that you continue to lead there.
Thank you, Janice. We appreciate your giving us this opportunity as well.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much.